there's one in particular that stands above all others, and that's connection. And a lot of times couples come in and they say, we're having trouble communicating. You know, we're having trouble talking without arguing, and we're having trouble bridging our differences. And I watch them because, you know, part of being a couples therapist is you listen to people say what the problem is, but we're also watching very carefully to see how people interact and what clues can we get from just the way they're interacting.
Welcome to the Wealthy, Wealthy, Wise podcast. If you would like to listen in on thought-provoking conversations with countercultural thought leaders and experts in the fields of wealth, health, and relationships, the three keys to having what I call a wealthy, wealthy life, then this is the show for you. I'm Christina Wise, real estate investor, best-selling author, Falling for Money, and founder of Wealthy Wealthy, where I serve as your personal guide to money, health, and happiness. Welcome back to Wealthy, Wealthy, Wise. This is Christina Wise, your host, and in this episode, I interview John Howard. John is a couples therapist, and he's focused on what he calls the new science of relationships. Now, what do science and love have to do with one another? Well, what John says is the science, the biology of our body gets in the way of our loving another or even feeling loved. How and why? Because we have this nervous system that reacts. It reacts to triggers. It reacts to fears, a fear of abandonment, a fear of rejection, a fear of not being right. The long laundry list of fears that we all bring to a relationship. So John talks about some techniques for how to notice these, manage these, and really learn the skill of being loving as a verb, the skill of being in a relationship, reaching a place of workability, and ultimately being in a relationship that is just tied to the feeling of connection. And feeling connected is feeling loved. So I hope you enjoy this episode. It's full of so many relationship nuggets. Well, hello, John. It is so much fun to be here with you today. Thank you for being part of the Wealthy, Wealthy, Wise podcast.
Hi, Christina. It's exciting to be here with you.
I am really thrilled to have this conversation. It's so funny. We're both here in Austin, Texas, and we've been juggling trying to make this happen, which life is just crazy busy. And then we were going to do this live at my house here in Austin, but then Airbnb kicked me out. So I'm in an Airbnb at Hickory, and now here I'm in a, somebody else's house as an Airbnb. So life is crazy, but I'm so glad that we're able to make this happen. So what I'd love to for you to share to start off is when we first got to know each other, we've known each other for years now. How long has it been?
I would say 3 or 4 years at least.
Yeah, at least. And so I had a lot of fun, been watching you, your work. I'm such an admirer of your work and of you as well. And but when we first started getting to know each other, you told me about your story, which is a fascinating story, which I really, you know, and I think you said that was really what led you to the work that you're doing as a relationship expert and relationship therapist. But share with everyone listening your own story, because it's fascinating.
Well, I grew up in New York City. I'm Cuban American. My mom is a Cuban immigrant. She came over with just a backpack on her back after the Cuban Revolution, married my dad, who was born here in the United States. And my parents were not kid people. So I actually did not live with my parents growing up. They lived in a separate apartment building in New York and focused on adult life. And I was raised by my Cuban grandmother, my mom's mom, who she eventually brought over from the island, who didn't speak any English. And she was basically my mom and dad. And it was my sister and I who lived in the apartment with her. So I grew up speaking Spanish, and my parents weren't around very much. And at 4, I was sent to kindergarten, which was, you know, early to start kindergarten. So I was younger than everyone. I was smaller than everyone. I felt like the runt of the litter. Plus, I didn't speak the language. So making friends was really difficult for me. And all through grade school, I just felt really isolated, you know, lonely at home and at school. You know, I didn't really know why I felt so disconnected, but that was just my experience. And as an adult, I've been able to reflect more on it, you know, the neglect that I experienced, the lack of playmates, the lack of attention at home, you know, really struggling to make friends at school. And then what happened in the fourth grade was that my grandmother died. And my family was so miserable at communication. You know, I mean, already it was part of the culture to not say I love you, to not hug. You know, people would just kind of get wrapped up in their own stuff. But when my grandmother died, everyone thought it was best to not talk about it at all. So I actually didn't even know that she died until I found out from a family friend later on. And that was a really disruptive moment in my life because, of course, I had awesome grief, but I didn't really have a context for how to process that grief. I didn't have the emotional support to feel it, much less talk about it. So life became really confusing. It became so difficult that I had to repeat the fourth grade because I couldn't really focus on anything. And of course, the adults around me were very clueless when it came to mental health and relationships. And so they were all scratching their heads, wondering, you know, why is he struggling, you know, academically all of a sudden and not really connecting it to this big event in my life. So I didn't really have a chance to process what happened. It was like losing my mom and dad at age 9 until I was much older and I was able to reflect back on it and go, wow, I grew up in a really messed up family where there was a complete and total lack of emotional support, a complete and total lack of communication. We didn't talk about anything really except sort of the weather and maybe world events at times. And I remember sitting in the fourth grade, Christina, when all of this was happening to me, really wondering as a kid, why are we memorizing another set of Algebra 2 equations when we really should be talking about how to love and care for one another? And I knew back then, partly from my own pain and partly just out of observation, that as a culture, we're really missing the boat when it comes to teaching ourselves what's most important about life. And this has been said before, and it's been said by you around money, especially, that we don't get the class around money that we really should get. And it's so true about relationships as well. So I knew back then that something was broken, and I would go home and talk to whoever would listen. Why aren't we learning about love? Why aren't we learning about care? Why aren't we learning about compassion? And nobody had a good answer. And so when I got older, I decided, you know what? I'm going to actually create that class. I'm going to build a school. I'm going to make it my mission to make sure that kids who aren't seeing healthy relationships at home have some example of what a healthy relationship is, because I think that's so critical to success in life.
And thank you for sharing that story. And I think that's where we talked a little bit. We shared that I grew up in a very similar upbringing and that there weren't parents around. There wasn't the loving parents there. They weren't kid friendly. You know, they really put us kids over and so that they could do, like you said, their adult things. And so I'm so curious, like starting from that type of upbringing where there wasn't really connection, there wasn't real love, there wasn't real affection, there really wasn't communication. We had to grow up probably faster. We were on our alone. We were lonely as kids because we had to figure out how to entertain ourselves and keep ourselves busy. So how does that transform into later on healthy adult connectivity and love in relationships when we started from not having a good example?
So there's something in the relationship research literature called earned secure, which I know you know something about as well. And earned secure is when we learn as adults to have secure, healthy relationships, even though we didn't experience them as kids. So there is a path to that. It's not like you're just screwed, you know, if you had a bad childhood. There's absolutely a way to learn how to have and practice healthy relationships. But people need to understand what that path is. It's not just talking about relationship health conceptually. It actually involves a lot of motor memory, engagement, and real practice. You know, think about a soccer player trying to get good at kicking a goal from a certain place. You can't just read a book about that, right? You can't sit around and talk about it. You have to get the ball out, get on the field. You have to kick it 100 times, maybe 1,000 times. Musicians understand what I'm talking about, or if you're trying to learn a language. So it's the same with relationship skills. It turns out from neuroscience research that most of our actions and reactions in relationship are automatic and pre-thought. So they're using primitive circuits that, you know, are very fast, but they're not necessarily very reflective. So we can read books on relationship and go to workshops and so on, and we can learn a lot, but it's in those fast automatic movements that we make with our partners. That's where we need to have skill, and that's often where we don't have it if we didn't grow up with it. So part of the new approach to couples counseling and relationship health is to be practicing healthy relationship behaviors, doing and saying the things that connect us as people, even when it feels awkward, even when it feels inauthentic or uncomfortable. Just like someone would push themselves at the gym in order to be able to lift heavier weights, And then all of a sudden, when you can, it feels right, but at first it doesn't. That's sort of how we look at growing in our relationship skills in the field of psychology today. And for me personally, I just saw the evidence of that in my own life. You know, I could learn about relationships, but it didn't make me effective in my personal relationships until I started taking risks, until I started looking stupid, until I was willing to be more embarrassed and try things I had never done before and say things I had never said, and sort of be messy with it for a while until it got smoother.
So listening to that, it sounds like for you, when couples work with you, it's really going to practice. It's not necessarily going in there to dump all the my feelings or BS or my experiences onto the therapist, but it's going in there with an intention to work, to gain skill and use it as a practice session. Would you say then that, I guess, let me back up with the question then, that I think I know what the answer will be based on what you just said, but how many couples do I know that their relationship ended, but they went to years of therapy? I mean, what was happening in therapy, in your opinion, that, I mean, they wanted it to work. They're both willing to go to therapy. They're both willing to try. But at the end of the day, it didn't get any better, if not worse. And ultimately, the relationship ended.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit hard to say what happens because these situations are so complicated. From all the research that's been done on couples therapy, it's pretty clear that most couples engage couples therapy too late in the process of having dysfunction in their relationship. And there's only so much couples counseling can do to reverse years of resentment. And so sometimes even when people get into couples therapy, the relationship is already on track to end, and it's hard for people to overcome what's going on. Now, if people get in early, you know, and address things before they really become chronic and really intense resentments, then couples therapy is more effective. And a lot of times then the outcome will depend on the skill of the therapist, assuming that people are bought into the process, right? And not all couples therapists are built alike. There's a lot of therapists that see couples but don't have specific training in it. Even when you're talking about specialized couples therapists who do have that training, there's a lot of different approaches. And, you know, one common complaint about couples therapy is that it's a circular conversation that just kind of revolves around the same issues over and over again, and nothing really happens and nothing really changes. Another complaint is that it's a venting session and people just come in to complain about what's happening, you know, and their partner feels hurt hearing them complain, and then they trade. And so I think it's important, if people come in early enough for couples therapy to make a difference, that the therapist is really helping those two individuals practice themselves healthier relationship skills. So it's not just a venting sesh, you know, and it's not just talking about the issues. I'll give you an example. I had a couple come into my office, and her primary complaint was that he never appreciates her. He never compliments her. He never says anything directly to her that really validates and acknowledges her. Now, we could have spent an hour or two talking about that problem, right? Well, when does it happen? How long has it been going on? How do you feel when that happens? I could ask him, what's going through your mind? You know, why haven't you tried something? But instead, what I did with this couple was I turned to him and I said, show me how you appreciate her. And then I actually backed away from them in the therapy room. So I sort of left them on an island with these instructions. And what I wanted to see right away is, does he have the ability to, you know, are we dealing with some type of incapacity perhaps to vocalize certain things or feel certain things? And, you know, given those direct instructions, Christina, he said something to her that she had never heard him say before. And it was like all of a sudden this 10 years of complaining that he never says these things, he doesn't do these things, he's incapable, I'll never get this from him. In one moment, he said something to her that directly appreciated her. And the relationship was different. I think she realized, oh my God, he can, right? And so now it's just a function of how do we do this more? And I think he also surprised himself by watching her reaction of like, wow, I didn't realize this could be so simple. So sometimes the practice of relationship skills cuts out a lot of the BS. You know, these processing sessions we have with our partners and all this emotional stuff that flies around for hours. sometimes we need to cut to the chase and actually just do things and put our body in position to do the things that matter.
Yeah. And the word you keep using is skill. And that's what skill is. It's a trained behavior, basically, that usually we choose to improve. And if we want to be skillful at something, we start with little to no skill. And then we prove that over time with a lot of practice, some coaching, some training, but with some discipline, with doing it when we don't want to practice. But when is that ever applied to relationships? I mean, don't we grow up thinking that if there's love, if this person loves me or I love them, that there shouldn't be skill, that this should just be the most natural thing in the world? If it's romanticism forever, you know, forever after?
Christina, we have the most idiotic thoughts about relationship, and which is why so many people struggle. I mean, going back to the example of being in school, you know, that we get more training at stuff that hardly anybody uses than we do at the things that matter the most in our life. And relationships are hard. You know, they're complex, they're difficult just by their very nature. So when we don't have specific training or even basic training at something that's difficult and complex, of course, we're not going to do it well. But the social cost is so dramatic. I mean, you're talking about people's lives, you know, very, very high levels of stress, people that lose their careers because they can't focus. You're talking about kids growing up in homes where they're not feeling supported. They're not learning how to be emotionally intelligent. They're going to go off and have their own dysfunctional relationships. And I actually think the cost is even greater than home life. I think it extends to our politics, to our culture, to the way we treat people who are different from us, even to relationships between nations. So relationship training is absolutely critical. And it's always so surprising to me that we don't treat it like we do learning an instrument or learning a language or going to the gym, where it's so obvious to us that if we want to get really good at something, it's about motor memory, it's about repetition, it's about, like you said, building skill. And yet for some reason in our personal lives, we think these relationship skills are going to fall out of the sky because we have certain emotions towards someone.
Yeah, I find, and you and I have talked about that before, but especially in the relationship categories, because we have these feelings that it should be easy. And when we've talked about, for example, you and I, we've really been plagued or just like, what, why in this category of money and relationship, where it's so important to everyday happiness, security, fulfillment, meaning, stability, all these different words that are very important to us as human beings. It's where we spend the least amount of time learning and building a skill set. And these two, you're in my categories.
It's so shocking, you know, and as an adult, I'm learning more about money and you've helped me with that. And we've really appreciated that. And, you know, my dad was in finance. He was actually a tax attorney. And so he knew a lot about finance. I don't know that he knew a lot about wealth creation, but he knew a lot about, you know, money and money management and how to read financial statements and things like that. And I remember him trying to teach me some things, but it was almost impossible for me to understand it the way he wanted to teach it. It was almost like the financial world had these standard ways of trying to convey information that to me just never made any sense whatsoever. And it wasn't until later, you know, when I was able to interact with people like you and people that know how to communicate these concepts in a more simple manner, that I started learning about it. But you're right. I mean, these are such important areas of our lives. And when it comes to relationships, I think sometimes people have a little bit of shame or embarrassment to start practicing and training, because it's almost like we've made this assumption as a culture that we should be good at this, that because we're human, we come out of the box good at it or something like that. Where in fact, relationships require a tremendous amount of skill. They bring so much complexity into our lives, just how to manage personality differences and differences of habits, you know, how to argue well, how to make up. Just there's so many dimensions of relationship life, you know, sex, money management, parenting. There's no way that we're natively ready for a relationship like that without some training and practice.
I totally agree. And it's funny that, you know, even in teaching money and wealth strategy and that type of thing, I mean, there are some complexities to it. But overall, when I compare it to something like relationships, it's so easy, you know, like I was much happier at my job than your job. But anyway, so let's talk about that. What do you see when you're working with couples that come in? Is there maybe like a top three problems that are pretty foundational and fundamental that you're spending like 80% of the cases, it's going to be the case that they're coming in with one of these three?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there's one in particular that stands above all others, and that's connection. And a lot of times couples come in and they say, we're having trouble communicating. You know, we're having trouble talking without arguing, and we're having trouble bridging our differences. And I watch them because, you know, part of being a couples therapist is you listen to people say what the problem is, but we're also watching very carefully to see how people interact and what clues can we get from just the way they're interacting, not necessarily what they say the problem is. And typically when I watch people interact, I notice that they're making certain errors around connection that they don't realize they're making. So when they say the problem is communication, well, occasionally it might be, but the vast majority of the time, what's actually going on there is that people don't feel connected. And they're translating that as a communication problem, but it may not be. And most of the time, what's really going on in relationships that are failing, that don't have that spark, that mojo anymore, or people are feeling resentful with each other, is there's a lack of connection, a fundamental connection. And there's no amount of communication that can really surmount that. You know, we all know that feeling when we're with somebody we just don't feel connected to, and you're trying to use communication to somehow feel connected. And after a while, it just gets annoying. You know, there's something more basic than communication that our nervous system needs to feel connected to someone. It has a lot to do with whether we feel safe and secure with someone. It has a lot to do with whether we feel treated fairly and respected as an equal at a fundamental level. And those things are the things that generally people are arguing about without realizing it. So they make the argument about the kids or about the dishwasher or about cleanliness. But when I watch people interact, what I notice is that more often than not, they just don't feel connected enough to make communication errors, which, you know, people who are connected make lots of communication errors and it doesn't bother them in the least. You know, think about hanging out with your best friend. There's so much goodwill there. There's so much trust built up. Who the hell cares how you say things? I mean, there's a limit to that maybe, but you can get away with saying things all kinds of ways and, you know, not responding when somebody asks you a question right away or whatever, because the goodwill and the connection is really strong. So mainly I help people with connection. And when they get that piece, a lot of the other supposed issues fall into place.
Yeah, and when connection, you mean, I know the feeling of any sort of, let's say, conflict, not necessarily that that's a bad word, but there's a breakdown or conflict or an issue that you have two parties wanting to resolve. And it's really this desire to be heard or be understood. Like, oh, you're just not understanding me. That's not what I'm saying. And, you know, how do you get past that? Is that connection, meaning I'm not feeling understood. I don't feel like we're connecting. Like, yeah. I know that that sounds like what I'm trying to say, but that's not what I mean. I mean, I need you to understand me. So does that factor into that?
Right. So if you try to use communication to address those moments, it ends up falling a little bit flat. Even if somebody reflects back to you exactly what you've said, you know, and they use communication tools like reflective listening, et cetera, and somebody says, okay, Christina, fine. Look, here's what you said, you know, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Satisfied. So, you know, communication tools by themselves just aren't enough. What we're really looking for, like you said, is authentic connection, care, empathy, interest, curiosity. You know, that's something that we feel. It's either there or it's not. And if it's not, communication is not going to bridge the gap. Mm. But if it is, you can make lots of communication mistakes and it doesn't really matter. So the question I always ask is, why are people feeling disconnected? What's really at the root of this? And in the kind of situation you're talking about where we just don't feel heard and understood and it's getting really frustrating, we have to realize in those moments that communication may not get us across the finish line. And we sort of have to stop what we're doing and switch gears. Sometimes I call this a pause and pivot, right? You pause in order to recognize that what you're doing isn't working. And then you're willing to pivot with your partner onto a different type of interaction. action. So a pause and pivot in that situation might sound like, you know what, hold on a second. Let's just pause for a minute because this conversation is getting frustrating. I think what I'm just really needing from you is to feel like you care about me. Can we just sort of pause for a minute and just maybe just spend a little bit of time on that basic thing? Because I think even more than the thing I'm saying, I just want to feel like you're really interested in me. So what I've done there is I've taken the burden off of fancy communication and I've put it back on a basic sense of connection. And that's something that's a little bit easier to handle.
Yeah, that's actually really helpful. Anybody listening, write that one down. Anyway, so that was number one. You said you see that most often is this just people are trying to communicate. They're meaning well, but there's a fundamental disconnection. What else do you see? Are there any other things that are pretty prevalent?
Sure. Now, connection is a big area. So, you know, connection has a lot of sub-departments, if you will. Like you and I have talked before, understanding the nervous system is a really key part of getting how the connection system works, because the connection system doesn't use the fancy thinking part of the brain. It's looking for more primitive cues and evidence that somebody cares about us. So the nervous system, for example, pays attention to how close somebody is to us physically, whether they're touching us or not, how much eye contact we're making. You know, the nervous system is looking for more primitive signs that care is in place. And so a lot of times the mistake we're making is we're using words to mediate connection. And words are cumbersome and they're complicated and often annoying. And so if we get more primitive, we're actually able to speak more directly to the communication system. So when people are struggling with connection, one thing I recommend is, you know, sit closer any opportunity that you get. Because if you're standing at 4 or 5 feet apart or you're sitting at opposite sides of the table, it's that much harder for the nervous system to feel connected. And when you're physically close, reach out and touch each other. Hold hands, put an arm around each other, give each other a back rub, because immediately that's a nonverbal signal to the nervous system that you love each other and that you care for each other. You know, watch your tone of voice, make eye contact, look friendly. Things like that. So before we even engage words, we can send very, very powerful signals of connection. And for most of us in the modern world that, you know, use language a lot and we're trained to use language as a way to mediate connection, our practice is actually to get simpler and dumber with the things that we do. When we see our partner, for example, just hug and hold it. You don't have to talk so much right away. You know, hold hands, sit together, make eye contact. I don't know if you remember, Christina, but the New York Times article that covered the research from the 60s on whether people could be made to fall in love, which was really interesting. And the New York Times journalists that covered the research actually fell in love with each other. And it made the article so much more interesting because they wrote about their experience of testing it and then actually falling in love. And that whole protocol involves deep, sustained eye contact. And then questions that are designed to really get under the surface, like I really know you type questions. And so it turns out that love is not as mysterious as we thought, that if we make these connecting moves that signal security to the nervous system and we show interest and curiosity, it's quite easy to fall in love with the people that we're interacting with.
Well, and it does, it makes a lot of sense. And on the nervous system level, that is often missed. And that's many times when people probably are, relationships are having some of the biggest arguments or debates, when resources are low, when the nervous system is already being taxed, high stress, really stressful things at work, didn't eat much today, didn't sleep much last night. And now let's go ahead and talk about money, you know.
Right. Is that at 3 a.m. Right. In the morning? highly anxious. You know, and to answer your question, Christine, in terms of other issues that couples deal with. So communication is a problem. You know, I don't want to minimize it. I mean, sometimes it is legitimately an issue where people just don't have basic communication skills and it's getting in the way. And one way to think about that, I was recently interviewing Ellen Bader, who I think of as the founder of couples therapy, and she's incredibly wise in these things. And she said something that stood out to me. She said, you know, one of the biggest problems she sees is what she calls other differentiation. And that's kind of a complicated term, but what she means by that is that people don't hold still while their partner is sharing their truth, okay? So it's one thing for us to share our truth. A lot of times that's hard for us to do. It's hard for us to take a risk and say, you know what, I'm different from you, and here's my truth, and here's my reality, and I'm sorry if you don't like it. That's hard enough. But what's even harder is when other people are sharing their truth with us. Can we hold still and receive it and appreciate it? Or are we constantly interrupting, jumping in, you know, trying to correct the record, debating, which is a lot of the times what we're actually doing. So when I work with couples on communication specifically, one of the things we work on is, do people have the ability to listen without anxiety? Because listening to somebody else is naturally anxiety producing. You know, we think of a million things we disagree with. You know, there's 10 things that we would say differently or whatever. We want to get into a debate because it's fun. And so a lot of the times we're not very good listeners because of that underlying anxiety. So with communication, it's really practicing breathing, you know, planting our feet on the floor, feeling our bodies, and using little mental tricks to really hang in there. You know, like I did a video on how to watch your partner like a movie, which is a mental trick, because when we watch movies, we are silent and we get engrossed in what we're watching. And so that's a little bit of a trick if we find ourselves interrupting a lot, is, well, pretend your partner is the movie of the day, you know, and just lean back in your chair and watch and listen. And enjoy and appreciate and learn. And so communication is an issue, and there's some tricks to help people with that. Of course, as you know, money is a big issue in relationships, and so is sex and romance and attraction. And so I would say those are generally, along with parenting, the big areas where partners seem to get in trouble.
And how much do you see that causes constant friction is this desire to be right? So I'm sure I'm right. I'm going to convince you that I'm right. I'm going to fight to the death until you tell me I'm right.
I mean, it's a big, big problem, you know, especially because in Western society, we prize logic. We prize logic over emotional intelligence. And so we're trained to believe that logic is correct and logic is what is valuable, when in fact, being able to listen to a variety of diverse perspectives and feelings and emotions is much more valuable because people are different. So if you need a common set of facts, you're constantly going to be fighting with each other. And what we know from neuroscience research is that our memories don't encode the same experience the same way. Memory is built on perception. And so because we perceive things differently, one person might be more analytic and one person might be more feelings oriented. That means we don't remember the same events the same way, right? We encode them differently. And then it's this stupid, never-ending fight about who said what, when, and what actually happened, which is completely useless. And so especially with the engineers I work with and sometimes physicians and attorneys, people who are more logic-oriented, I have to remind them that emotional intelligence, even though it's not taught and valued in school in the same way as logic, emotional intelligence is more important in personal relationships. The ability to really hold multiple different truths as equal, the ability to support someone even though you may not agree with what they're saying, and to really just show care and empathy and validation whether you agree with someone or not. These are such important skills that have quickly gotten lost. And I think it's part of the problem with our politics today as well.
I was going to say, just look on Facebook and it brings out the worst in people. And,
exactly.
You know, there's no emotional intelligence there. It is talk about reactive and unable to hold more than your own truth at one time. But yeah, and this is with people that, you know, that or friends or colleagues or that type of thing. And imagine what might be happening at home.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's awful in our politics and in social media. And it's partly because we've lost the skill to disagree respectfully and with appreciation for different points of view. And just to make this practical for everybody watching and listening, you know, if you find yourself in a stupid argument like that, you know, which is about who is right and who has the better idea. And, you know, did that actually happen or not? I don't think it did. One way to get yourself out of that is to feel into yourself and ask yourself, what's really important to me in this moment? Because if I achieve my victory of being right, the unfortunate effect is that someone else is going to be wrong. And that never feels good to anybody. People want to feel valued and validated in their different perspectives. So vulnerability is a really key tool in those stupid arguments, because if I know what I'm actually wanting from this, and it's not necessarily a victory on the facts, but like you said, Christina, it's to feel appreciated and respected as a person for how I experience things, then what we can do is we can bring vulnerability into the conversation. And instead of continuing this dumb fight, what we might say is something like, you know what, let's just pause here for a minute because I'm noticing getting really frustrated in this conversation. And honestly, I don't really care whether we remember it the same way. What I think I'm really wanting to feel is respect and validation, you know, for having an experience, for being a human being with my own experience. So let's put the focus on that so we're not having a stupid argument that's focused on logic. So, you know, vulnerability is a very powerful tool that we don't use enough. And in those dumb arguments, it's a really helpful one.
Something you say quite often in your work is the science of relationships. Science and love seem to be the opposites of one another. So what do you mean by the science of relationships?
Well, that's part of the problem, I think, that we experience in our relationships, is that we have love in this mystical, mystery, X factor category that is, you know, we say, well, love is hard to explain, you know, love is unpredictable, attraction is this big mystery. It's actually not. I think we just say those things to justify the fact that we don't give ourselves any training and knowledge about what we call love. Now, love itself can mean a lot of different things, but you know, a lot of times we talk about love as being a feeling that we have towards someone. And honestly, typically what that feeling is a sense of safety and security combined with attraction and familiarity. So we're not really talking about a weird X factor mystery set of feelings that fall from outer space. We're just talking about the same basic feelings that we have in life. It's just that when they all converge with a single person, it's that feeling that we refer to as love when we see that person as a potential life partner, as a potential romantic partner, and we're interested in them intellectually, and we're fascinated by their emotional dimension. And so when all of that comes together, we tend to call it love. The other problem with love is that love can be fleeting. You know, I mean, once we get into choppy territory and the relationship gets difficult, sometimes that feeling that we call love doesn't hang around. And a lot of times people think, oh my God, this relationship has to end because I don't feel the same kind of love that I felt. Well, again, you know, that type of love is not what sustains a long-term relationship. That type of love is a feeling, it's an emotion, it's wonderful, it feels great. But what actually sustains a long-term relationship is more on the science side of it, which is how do you convey a sense of safety and security consistently with someone over time? How do you feed the intellectual and emotional dimension of your connection consistently over time? And when people do that with each other, they may not have the same butterflies in their belly that they did in the first few months, but they have a deepening and a maturing love that actually grows, and it becomes even more beautiful than that initial feeling.
So again, to go back to what is in most people's way, because I guess let me ask you a question. What percentage, you're in the relationship business, what percentage, if you're just going to guess, of people you see, you know, you work with, that inspire you, that you inspire, that you hang out with, have dinner with, on the soccer field with, that type of thing, it's school board meetings with, what percentage would you guess have a strong, good marriage where it's a loving marriage and, you know, they would both say, yeah, I love my marriage. You know, it's more than just kids or it's more than just serving a certain purpose, but yeah, I have a great marriage.
Well, I would say good and great are different. So if we're talking about good, I would say my guess would be, 40% or so might say that they have a good marriage. But when you're talking great, I think that's rarer air. I think it's more refined territory there. And the amount of people that are able to say, I have a great marriage, is much, much less. And, I would guess it's probably 10% at the most, probably more like 5% of couples out there.
And what do you think they would say if I were to ask them, or you were to ask them, wow, I so rarely hear someone say, I have a great marriage. If you ask them that, what do you think they would say why they have a great marriage? Why are they 5%, such a small percentage?
One thing I notice, and I think this is also borne out in research that's been done to sort of illustrate, okay, what is it about couples that say they have a great relationship? I think oftentimes what they say is that they're very honest with each other. They're both comfortable being themselves with each other. So they can tolerate a lot of honesty. They're not walking on eggshells, for example, which happens a lot in relationships. We're afraid of conflict. We're afraid to rock the boat. We start holding things back. We start getting resentful. We start not saying things. And pretty soon that becomes the culture of our relationship. So I think people that say they have a great relationship are people that are taking constant risks with each other. They're saying the inconvenient thing, but they're saying it in a loving way that invites care. They're not saying it in a way that's attacking or threatening. Because honesty, it can be a weapon as well, right? So I'm talking about the kind of honesty that actually invites interest and care and curiosity. A lot of times, another difference I would say is a lot of times when we're frustrated in our relationships, what we do is we complain and we criticize and we judge. And then we use guilt as this kind of lever to get our partner to change what they're doing. And of course, all those things are very toxic to relationships. So I think what great couples do is when they're frustrated with each other, which is inevitable, they don't use criticism and judgment and guilt as levers to change behavior. What they do is they share vulnerably from their heart what they're experiencing, and they trust their partner to care about that. It's a lot easier to care for somebody when they vocalize something vulnerably, right? Rather than as a criticism or as a judgment of you. So I think people that have a great marriage are just in the habit of really, they're being honest, but they're also inviting care through authentic vulnerability.
So let's create an example, if you will, for an example, like the same situation, meaning I'm frustrated. So I'd like to say this to my partner. What is one way to say it that would sound or be taken or actually is criticism? And what would be the opposite or the other way to say it that would invite the care?
Okay, so what we often do, which is in the criticism category, is we get frustrated and then we say something like, "Ah, you always do this to me when we get into conversation. It just makes me so mad. I don't know why you keep doing this, because every time I tell you that it hurts me and that I don't like it, I wish you would just care enough to actually change it. Go see a therapist or something, figure yourself out. Because this is really annoying to me that you continue to do that," right? So it's a criticism, it's a judgment, it's an attack. I'm using guilt as leverage. Sometimes,
and it sounds like a reprimand.
Yeah. And sometimes we're not as harsh about it. Sometimes it's a little bit more subtle, but it's still a criticism where we might say something like, it's so disappointing to me that you always do this when we talk. I don't know why you don't know how to communicate the way normal people do. Maybe it was your family, but gosh, I wish you could actually learn how to do this better. So that's the same thing, where it's going to make somebody feel awful, and then it's going to make the relationship feel awful. And we're going to have to dig ourselves out of that hole somehow to feel comfortable with each other again. So instead of that, what's much more helpful and actually builds connection is take the same frustration, right? Which is, inside I'm just seething. I'm just so frustrated that I'm not getting what I need from my partner, that they're not listening, they're not understanding. And I have to take ownership of that experience and invite my partner to care for me. That is really the critical part of this, is so often when we're criticizing, it's because we don't expect our partner to be very helpful to us. It's almost like we're yelling at a wall or something. And that lack of expectation of care is part of the problem. So when we're vulnerable, what that means is I know I'm frustrated with you right now, but I still expect you as my partner to be helpful to me. Okay, so that's still in the system somewhere. So what I will say is something more like, you know what, hold on a second. I'm sorry, I'm sure you probably don't intend this. You're probably not trying to make me frustrated, but I'm getting so frustrated in this conversation and I really don't want to be with you. And you probably don't want me feeling this frustrated either. Can we just stop here for a second and focus on what's making me so frustrated? Because I think actually if you helped me with it a little bit, I might be able to overcome it and then we'll have a much better conversation. So what I'm doing is I'm owning my experience. I'm not projecting it and blaming somebody for it. I'm sharing what it is vulnerably, right? And saying, look, this is happening to me. It's hard for me. I'm having a difficult moment here. And then I'm also appealing to care. I'm inviting you and asking you to help me, which all three are very important ingredients of turning conflict around. And the moment that I do that, my partner all of a sudden sees themselves as a helper and as a supporter. So they feel good about themselves. And what happens is they do put their focus on what we need. And all of a sudden we're in a connecting type of interaction.
Yeah, with trying to get to the same result, basically, and helping each other get there as opposed to being on opposite sides in tug of war.
Right.
Awesome. So to circle back a little bit where we started, those, let's say, that have come from, let's say, more dysfunctional backgrounds in the relationship category that tends to be in many categories, but what does it take extra work for those of us that didn't have good models that really didn't receive natural loving parental love, connection, affection, communication, patience, tolerance, laughter, the different things that you see built in into parenting of children, that those children know they're loved, as opposed to where we started? I don't think we knew that. So do we require maybe more knowledge, more coaching, more study to be introduced to things that maybe weren't there naturally, if that makes sense, if that question makes sense?
Yes, it makes sense. And yes, we do. Absolutely. We need more. We need to focus on ourselves and understand our deficiencies, because very often what we tend to do as humans is replicate relationship patterns. So whatever we experienced as kids is often what we gravitate towards without even knowing it. And so if you didn't get a lot of emotional support, it's real easy to find partners that aren't very emotionally supportive and to not expect it, because it's just not really on your radar. And as we get healthier, we start to expect more, which means we go looking for partners that can deliver more. But that takes a lot of work on ourselves. So I think those of us that did not grow up with healthy relationships can benefit greatly from individual therapy to sort of explore, okay, what didn't I get? And how can I be more tuned to bringing those elements into my life as an adult? And our relationship lives themselves are tremendous paths of healing as well. You know, we started off today talking about earn secure, which is someone's ability to learn relationship security and those automatic habits that lead to it, even though we didn't get that as kids. And earn secure is something that comes out of a relationship. It's a relationship product. It's not something that we just develop on our own by meditating or journaling or going to individual therapy. So while those activities, I think, are important for us to process our past, connect the dots, understand our family a little bit better, there's nothing like a real relationship to offer a path of healing and growth for the parts of us that aren't very good at relationship. And Christina, when I started having mature relationships, I was completely awful at them. I was really, really inept. I would make people feel very, very frustrated with me. And I had to claw and scratch my way to just a basic level of relationship skills. So I know that it can be done. I also know it takes a lot of work and focus. But I think if those of us that didn't grow up in supportive environments are sincere, you know, about wanting to learn it, I think there's certainly a path for it. And the worst thing we can do is be arrogant with our partners. because our partners will see all this stuff before even we do. So those of us that are trying to learn how to be healthy, we have to be very humble in our relationships. We have to keep in mind, you know, this was not taught to me as a kid. This was not something that was normal for me. I'm still awkward with it. And our partners are going to catch those things. So the mistake is to be arrogant, which unfortunately a lot of people do, is even though they didn't have a good relationship model, they still are sort of high and mighty about their supposed relationship skills. And really what's best is to be very humble, to listen closely to our partners, to take their feedback into account. What I do with my partner, Christina, is I listen very closely to what she says about her experience in being in a relationship with me. And I make those concrete goals. I write them down. I work on them. I keep them top of mind. I bring them into my individual therapy, but I also bring them into my conversations with her. And every now and then I'll say, hey, sweetheart, tell me how I'm doing on this thing. You know, have I improved? Have you noticed anything different? Do I need to do more work on it? Is there a part of it you feel like I'm not looking at? So when we're willing to be proactive and humble about it, I think our learning curve accelerates dramatically.
Wow, that is so good. All right, to just a couple more questions to close this out. But what do you say about distraction and distraction devices? And in this crazy, busy life that we're in, I mean, I can't tell you, almost every time, I mean, I'm actually shocked going out to eat at an expensive restaurant and couples are sitting together and they're not looking at each other and talking. They're both on their phones. And I mean, it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. So I'm just, what is this? And how, I mean, we're all victim to this. It's very easy to pick up the phone and a text comes in or the ping comes in. And next thing you're having dinner, you feel you're having a conversation. And they're looking at their phone. So what do you have to say about this? Isn't this destroying relationships? And talk about connectivity and wanting to be connected when we have somebody right there, right on the other side of the table, yet we're with our devices, you know? I'm just like, whoa, what is this?
Christina, I am just so glad that you asked this question because it's one of the most important things that we need to be talking about when it comes to relationship life. And I focus on this a lot, but my answer is probably not what you might expect. I'm not one of those people that rants against the rise of technology, if you will. And, you know, personally, I don't think of technology as inherently ruining our relationships. But I think what is true is that we haven't learned how to be with computers and technology and the internet in a way that also allows us to preserve the human element of connection. You know, computers are a part of our evolution as creatures and our evolution as a society. And so I don't think it's as simple as saying, you know, we need to get rid of these things and go back to human-to-human interaction, because it's just a part of how we live and how we do business and how we do everything these days, and probably a really good part of our evolution. However, the problem is that our nervous systems evolve over hundreds of thousands of years. So it's not like 30 to 40 years of technology suddenly reset how our nervous systems evaluate connection. Connection is still being determined according to the rules of interaction that have been around for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions of years. And that's the part that we have to understand is, you know, devices are great, computers are great, the internet is great, technology is great. But if it gets in the way of allowing our nervous systems to drink in connection the way they're designed to do, then we're definitely harming our relationships. And I think you're absolutely right. What happens very often these days is that people come home and they're on their phone and they're checking their emails, and then texts are coming in and they're responding to those. And if they're not doing that, they're on Facebook. And if they're not on Facebook, they're turning on Netflix. And if they're not on Netflix, they're on the internet looking at the news. And music's playing in the background and the TV is on and the kids are all watching different things. And we have to recognize that that is not an environment that's conducive to connection. Now, that's not to say there's not value in technology. In fact, some couples, some partners can be more connected through technology than not having it, right? We have to understand that for some couples, let's say couples where one person is deployed in the military and is abroad for 6 months, that there are partnerships where technology is a key way that keeps communication alive. And, you know, even in our relationships, texting back and forth, communicating information, who's going to pick up the kids. I mean, all of that is good, especially if we're sending, you know, warm romantic emojis and, you know, loving messages and things like that. Technology can be a way that we feed connection. But we have to understand that we cannot mediate connection through devices. It's just not the way that the nervous system does it. And we have to very intentionally put these things down, get them away, turn them completely off so that we're not subject to the dings and the buzzes and all this kind of stuff that will interrupt connection. There has to be times each and every single day that we get these things out of our system and we look each other in the eyes and we connect body to body, heart to heart, and we say meaningful things to each other. You know, we have meaningful conversation with each other. One of the reasons why the two youngest generations, generations Y and Z, are the most lonely. So if you look at mental health research, the youngest among us are the most lonely among us. And they also have the most mental health problems. And part of the reason for that is they're almost always mediating connection through technology, right? It's just how they do it. So this eye-to-eye, you know, person-to-person, body-to-body, deep, meaningful communication that used to be more the norm before we had devices is almost, you know, something that kids don't do anymore. So it's so important, and I'm glad you brought it up, that we get these things away for an hour or two every day, and we give our nervous system the opportunity to really connect.
I love that. All right, one final question that I close up all my interviews with, and to do a little myth busting. So you, I've been around you for a while, and the way you approach relationships as far as counseling, as a therapist, as an expert, and who you've studied and really what you teach is it's countercultural. I mean, it doesn't go really according to the conventional wisdom of relationship advice. So I'm assuming you come across what you would call myths, just kind of falsehoods or even not, maybe straight out lies in a way. So what's a myth you'd really like to bust that you come across over and over and over and you just like to yell to the masses, that's not true. I want to replace it with this, that what I believe is the truth.
So my favorite myth to bust, Christina, because it's so prevalent even among relationship coaches and some therapists, is the idea that you have to work on yourself as an individual in order to have a great relationship. Now, everything in relationships is complex because we're dealing with human beings and unique perspectives and habits. So I don't want to get too simplistic with this. And even I said earlier, it's really helpful, you know, to get into individual therapy and understand your family history and work on some things. And I do that in my life. So this is not meant to be reductionistic and say, you know, individual growth doesn't matter or anything like that. There's this myth, Christina, that to have a good relationship, we have to work on ourselves and then bring a better self to that relationship. And I'm going to explain why that's a myth. There's an assessment tool in psychology called the attachment inventory. And we used to give it to people to measure whether we predicted them to have healthy relationships or unhealthy relationships. So we thought that this individual score would kind of tell us whether somebody was ready for a relationship or not. And for a long time, that was considered valuable, right? Where we would give people this assessment, they would fill it out. We would say, okay, here's your score. You know, you might have some things to work on before you get into relationship. Well, here's what we understand now from the influence of neuroscience, is that relationships are much more about how two people work well together, not the individual health of each person, okay? A relationship is like a team function. And if you think of any team, you don't necessarily need to have two superstars. You just need to have two people who coordinate really well with each other. And it turns out that two people that coordinate really well will outplay people that bring in individual talent but don't play well together. Okay. So this idea that we can go off on our own and, you know, we can take psychedelics in the jungle and meditate and do a lot of individual therapy and it'll make our relationships so much better is a bunk idea. The only way we know that we're doing relationship better is the evidence that our relationships themselves give us about how we're showing up. Because the stuff we do individually is just not challenging enough. It's not stressful enough. It's not complex enough to replicate a relationship. So even though we do all that fancy stuff as individuals, and some of it is good, meditation in particular has been shown to have some beneficial effects on how people function in relationship. But it's just not, it's not the gold standard of how you get better at relationship. Relationship skills improve in relationship because they have to happen in the complexity and the stress and the difficulty that relationship itself creates. And sometimes we have this false idea that we're ready for a relationship because we've been doing all this individual work. Well, come to find out, when we actually get into a relationship, we're back to our old habits and patterns, right? Because the only way to remap those is by working with a partner, you know, either going to couples therapy or working with the partner that you're in relationship in. And if you don't have a partner, try to improve your friendships, try to improve your relationships with family members. That's the real litmus test of whether you're getting better at relationship. And that's a myth that I really like to bust.
That is so good. That's so good. So we will end there because I think if anybody listened to the entire interview or they just heard that piece, that's worth its weight in gold. So thank you so much, John. I appreciate you. I appreciate your work and all the goodness and the impact that you do with everything you're putting out. So, and you have a podcast and you have a course. We'll make sure to put all of that in the show notes so everybody can find you that want to build their skill of relationships. Tell me real quick, what are you doing on your podcast?
So our podcast is Ready, Set, Love, The New Science of Relationships. And I do interview people as well. We bring on relationship experts of different stripes, sometimes sex therapists, sometimes people that have an unorthodox or you know, a quirky perspective on relationships. I like to keep it fun. But we do very much focus on the science of connection and how you can learn to have a more connected relationship. And our 12-week course, which is at ReadySetLove.com, is a 12-week online course that partners can take. And the cool thing about it, Christina, is it's not just learning these concepts that you and I are talking about today, which are really powerful, but I give people the exercises that build their automatic relationship muscles. So I teach you a little bit about a principle of relationship health, and then I give you an exercise that you and your partner do together, and it builds those relationship muscles. And there's just not a lot of courses like that on the market, so I like to think it's pretty special. It's a great honor, Christina, to be on your show, so thank you so much for the opportunity. And I'm a big fan of your work, so I hope anyone that's listening that's from my community also looks into what you're doing and appreciates the power of it. Like I said, I've learned a lot about money management from you. And I think the systems you have for couples around managing money better and focusing on their health, et cetera, are just so, so valuable. And I hope that more people make use of those.
Well, thank you so much. And say hello to your beautiful wife, and we'll all get together soon.
All right. Thanks, Christina.
Thank you.
Bye.
And so ends another episode of the Wealthy, Wealthy Life podcast, where Christina brings you unconventional, cutting-edge strategies from leading experts to optimize your wealth and your health. As a token of gratitude for listening, go to podcast.fallingformoney.com and download a free copy of her best-selling book, Falling for Money. If you're ready to change your relationship with money, head on over to podcast.fallingformoney.com and download your free copy today.